It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Colin Clark, associate political scientist with the RAND Corporation, was booked to deliver the John T. Ryan Memorial Lecture at the Global Engagement and Leadership Luncheon long before last Friday's Paris attacks resulted in the deaths of 129 people. With the focus of the talk making sense of Syria, ISIS, Russia, and what comes next, the timing couldn't have been more prescient. Dr. Clark will deliver that address tomorrow at noon at the Duquesne Club. He teaches at both the University of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon University, and he is the author of the book Terrorism, Inc., The Financing of Terrorism, Insurgency, and Irregular Warfare. He joins us now in studio. Colin Clark, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
If you have a comment or question for our guest, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM. And you can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH. Colin Clark, in a piece that you co-authored last year for the Washington Post, you stated that step one in defeating militants from the Islamic State is to overmatch them and defeat their conventional aspirations. What do you mean by this?
So this is essentially talking about forcing them to fight as guerrillas, as insurgents, even though in certain cases that offers them an asymmetric advantage against the United States military. We've got such military overmatch that that's our best advantage. So here we want to focus on cutting off what we call forms of tangible support, the things that make the Islamic State powerful. So recruits, materiel, money, all of those types of things. So targeting those supply lines.
And how much does the whole social media aspect create a different dimension in this fight against the Islamic State?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of hyperbole surrounding the Islamic State and its capabilities. People have said, we've never seen such a group before, an insurgent group that's held territory and displayed these conventional military capabilities. And I don't think that's true. I think we have seen other groups, whether it was the Tamil Tigers or the Provisional Irish Republican Army. Where I don't think people are exaggerating is in talking about the group's ability to use social media, both at the same time to recruit new members and to terrorize the West, to display their propaganda. We've seen the beheadings that the group has carried out, the burning of the Jordanian pilot. And the group is particularly adept at targeting specific demographics, almost like a marketing company would.
And, of course, there's the funding issue. And the question is, one of the bigger challenges in stopping ISIS, as you've pointed out in your writings, is stemming their cash flow. And you've labeled ISIS's cash-producing ventures as gray and dark activities. Explain what those are.
Yeah, so those are comprised of a range of different activities. On the gray side, those are things that are kind of quasi-legal, so diaspora support, various types of fraud.
What would be an example of that?
So the people that are coming over to join ISIS are committing in Europe or abroad, particularly the foreign fighters, very small-level kinds of fraud, mortgage fraud, credit card fraud, the taking advantage of the VAT, the value-added tax, just enough money to fund their trips to get over there to bolster the Islamic State. But the organization's real moneymakers lie more in the dark activities. Here I'm talking about things like smuggling and trafficking, particularly of oil, where the group's thought to be making about $1 million a day.
And Vladimir Putin recently said that this was since the Paris attacks. He said that it was imperative to cut off the Islamic State's ability to get money from oil smuggling. That seems to be where a lot of their financing is coming from.
Absolutely. Although I would caution, even if we are successful in cutting off some of the funds from oil, which I think eventually we will be, the group will then simply rely more on your traditional mafia-style activities, things like extortion, protection, taxation. And the key there is that the group controls large swaths of territory throughout Syria and Iraq. So it's a kind of reproducing source of revenue.
So how do you stop these activities?
Yeah, that gets to who we've got partnered on the ground with us, and that's really where we're lacking right now. That would talk to local law enforcement and security services, which we've seen in Iraq just haven't quite been up to snuff. And in Syria at this point are basically non-existent as we enter the fourth year of the civil war there.
Another point that you have made in your writings is that you have said that clouding what should be a genuine policy debate, much of the recent analysis about how to defeat the Islamic State tends to be based on no more than intuition, a general sense of history, or a small number of historical cases of questionable comparability, rather than solid and systematically collected historical evidence. To expand on what you're saying.
Yeah, so that's a not-so-subtle attack on some of the talking heads that like to compare everything to Vietnam, or, you know, they kind of cherry-pick this one case and say, oh, this is exactly what we saw in case A, B, or C. What we did for a study called Path to Victory was we systematically analyzed every single insurgency, 71 in all, that began and ended between World War II and 2010. That way, we were able to gain greater fidelity on the data and to tease out what we saw as some broader patterns to inform policy analysis.
And what would be some of the patterns that you discovered?
Yeah, so and I talk about this in the kind of abbreviated Washington Post article for the Monkey Cage blog, which is really attacking those sources of tangible support. Because unless you do that and do that successfully, the insurgents almost always win.
And you mentioned that some people want to, you were sort of targeting this at the policy wonks, for lack of a better term, who say, you know, this is like fighting Vietnam. But Vietnam was largely a situation where the U.S. was battling guerrilla fighters. And you're saying this is the way we want to fight ISIS. We want to get them into a guerrilla-style fight.
Yeah, so I use Vietnam just as an example because that's the case. There are actually much more differences between the two cases than there are similarities. Although we are seeing now that, similar to Vietnam, there are a lot of complexities and nuances here, especially as more actors enter the fray, both state and non-state actors.
You know, ISIS is based largely in Syria and Iraq, but they have people all over the world acting on their behalf. You know, how hard does it make it to fight an entity that is not a nation state, that's, you know, unlike Al-Qaeda, you can't even say, and this is even oversimplifying it, but you can't even say that that Afghanistan is the place where we hunt down Al-Qaeda, because they're spread out. But ISIS seems to be even more spread out. You're not attacking a country or a nation. It's this entity that as soon as you cut off one part of it, one place, it grows somewhere else.
Yeah, so the commonly used analogy is whack-a-mole. And it's true, because while ISIS is primarily based in Iraq and Syria, they've now got regional franchise groups, or wilayats as they call them, in places like Libya, in places like the Sinai, in places like South Asia, in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and then creeping all the way up into the North Caucasus on the Russian border. So this is somewhat similar to the path that Al-Qaeda followed after the U.S. Really decimated core Al-Qaeda based in Pakistan during its kind of decade-long drone campaign. We saw that group rely more on its franchises, and here I'm talking specifically about Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which has kind of morphed into what we have today with ISIS.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking about the strategy of fighting ISIS, what to do about that situation, what the United States can do, who it can partner up with, and how some of the other countries that have been brought into this fight need to look at this. We're talking with Dr. Colin Clark of the RAND Corporation. He is the author of the book Terrorism, Inc., The Financing of Terrorism, Insurgency, and Irregular Warfare, and he is delivering an address at the Duquesne Club tomorrow, the John T. Ryan Memorial Lecture at the Global Engagement and Leadership Luncheon. If you have a comment or question for our guest, you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. What questions do you have? You may be wondering how ISIS operates, how it's funded, how they can be stopped, and what the discussions are like now between countries like France, the United States, and Russia since those attacks in Paris on Friday. And in response to last Friday's attacks, Colin, French President Francois Hollande said he wants to bring the United States and Russia together in a grand coalition dedicated to smashing the Islamic State group. Is this really genuinely possible? And if so, how do you see it working?
Yeah, so I think it is possible, although, you know, Russia, France, and the United States certainly make for strange bedfellows. Notice he didn't talk about invoking Article 5 of NATO, which is attack against one is attack against all, because those would be probably untenable positions where you'd have Russia and NATO sharing the same theater, because it's following the end of the Cold War. NATO expansion up to Russia's doorstep was seen by the Russians as one of the more provocative actions, kind of a thumb in the eye after the United States vanquished the Soviet Union. So I think the Russians, the U.S., and the French can work together as long as we're cognizant of the fact that other than defeating ISIS, a lot of the major players involved all have kind of different primary goals.
Is the likelihood, well, and I guess let me backtrack. What is Russia's goal in Syria? What is their primary goal? How does it differ from that of the United States? And how does it make it difficult for these two countries, the two former super, or Soviet Union being the former superpower, the United States being the superpower? What makes it difficult for them to now get on the same page?
Yeah, so I think the main sticking point is whether Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian president, stays or goes. And the Russians obviously want to keep Assad in power. The United States would like to see him gone. In addition to the U.S., I think some of the traditional Saudi power or Sunni powers in the region, the Saudis, the Turks, to a lesser extent, the Kuwaitis, Qataris, Emiratis, would like to see Assad gone. So the kind of underlying geopolitical reason for a lot of this is the Russian naval base in Tartus and their desire to maintain that and maintain a presence in the Eastern Mediterranean. And then I think kind of behind all that is what we've been seeing play out over the last few years, which is any chance Putin gets to show up the United States, he's going to take that opportunity. And I think that's maybe how this started. But with the recent admission that it was ISIS that bombed the Russian airliner in Sinai, he's kind of been dragged into the fray a bit more and kind of forced to confront the threat that is ISIS.
412-246-2002 is the number to call to join our conversation with Colin Clark. Let's go to Jim in Worthington. Jim, you're on Essential Pittsburgh. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hello. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, Jim. You are on the air. You are on the air, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you for doing this. It's a very interesting conversation with Dr. Clark. My question is, Dr. Clark, in your opinion, over the long run, how much of these military-type struggles against groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, how much of it can be reduced or possibly eliminated by really concentrating on cultural and ideological changes in a larger Muslim world?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think that speaks to, you know, one of the United States' main strengths, which is its soft power, right? The appeal of its culture and institutions. Although I'd caution there that that's very much a longer-term struggle, right? The immediate threat lies more in the kinetic realm, and by kinetic I mean, fighting this group with tanks, bombs, guns, etc. The more traditional elements of military power or hard power. I don't think it's one or the other. I think, you know, to have a true comprehensive strategy, we've got to have hard power along with soft power, along with probably a lot more resources dedicated to what I would call countering the narrative, right? So getting out there and countering this narrative, the kind of Salafi jihadi ideology that's permeated large parts of the Middle East and North Africa.
Thank you for that call, Jim. Let's go to Carol in Baldwin. Hi, Carol. You're on the air with Colin Clark.
Hello.
Yes.
I watched a PBS special last night called Frontline, and Frontline showed a documentary all about ISIS, and it was frightening. They showed, they're training children, 3 years old to 9 years old. They're showing them how to use the semiautomatic rifles. They show them documentaries or videos every day on beheadings. They said, we want the Islamic system over the world, and we need to fight for it. We need to protect God's religion. It was a frightening documentary.
Well, and you sound like you're still affected by it, Carol, and understand
yes.
Understandably so. What about what Carol's saying here, Dr. Clark, and the idea that one of the worst terrorists in the history of mankind, Adolf Hitler, he had the Hitler Youth, the secret to the Nazi success, up to the point at which it was vanquished by the Allied powers, was that he had indoctrinated youth from an early age to buy into this belief in Nazi superiority. What about the idea that ISIS is using that same strategy to a equal or greater effect?
Yeah, so this is very much a generational struggle, and it's evident in things like I think they call them the ISIS Cubs, this younger generation of recruits that they're now indoctrinating with their propaganda, with their ideology. But this isn't unique to ISIS. You mentioned the Hitler Youth. We've also seen other militant groups do this. Hezbollah runs a summer camp. The Tamil Tigers operate in much the same way. So the big challenge is going to, in a way that's feasible, show these younger generations that, this ideology is bankrupt. It does not represent true Islam, and that joining this group is only going to lead to one place. Now, if that place is, martyrdom, and that's something that's embraced by the group, that's something I think we've been grappling with from the beginning, and it's not something we've really figured out. As Secretary of State Kerry said, when people are determined to kill themselves, in a democracy, there's very little you can do.
Earlier this week, President Obama flat-out rejected calls for a shift in U.S. strategy against ISIS following the Paris attacks. Is the president's strategy on building an international coalition to launch airstrikes while training and equipping more moderate forces on the ground, is that the best approach?
So I think that this mission won't succeed if it's primarily U.S.-driven. I think this has to start and end with our allies in the region. Although we can offer fairly robust support, I think we've got to explore the full range of both kinetic and non-kinetic activities, choke off the group's financing, as I mentioned before, counter the narrative. And there has to be some kind of a move at some point to work with elements on the ground. Now, that comes with its own complications, right? So it's not as easy as, okay, arm the Kurds. They seem to be an effective fighting force. One of our allies in bringing this conflict to a close is Turkey, who are worried about their own kind of Kurdish issue. So there are all these caveats and nuances that go along with, which shows that we really don't have, at the end of the day, many good choices. And the president said he's against sending boots on the ground, but there are other things we can do, whether that's increasing the number of special operations forces, building the partner capacity of these local groups, training and equipping them, and potentially exploring the idea of a no-fly zone.
I want to go back to Russia and the United States in all of this. There has been an agreement that has reportedly been made between the United States and Russia reportedly Mr. Obama and Mr. Putin have agreed on a Syrian-led government transition with talks to be overseen by the United Nations. So does this represent some progress in at least in terms of mediating the differences between essentially what our two countries differ on when it comes to what should happen with Assad?
Yeah, so still way too early to tell. I think, we're going to have to see exactly what that means and whether that means Assad stays or Assad goes or whether he's replaced by one of his cronies. I think the wild card in a lot of this and a country that we haven't talked about yet but that we should is the role played by Iran. So Iran is also a primary backer of the Assad regime. Iran's got Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, Quds Force, military fighters training and fighting on the ground in Syria in defense of the Assad regime. We've also got Hezbollah fighters. And so this is the kind of double objective of both bolstering Assad, but then also anything that is counter to the United States and Israel is also always a plus for the Iranians.
Something that occurred to me is a similarity between, I talked about the Hitler Youth and the indoctrination that ISIS uses of young children. And, you know, ISIS really likes to frighten people with those videos. And certainly it is frightening to see human beings being beheaded. The Nazis used that, too. They used it against members of the German underground who were fighting against the Nazis. I believe it was Himmler who came up with the idea that, of using the guillotine, which was one way of executing people who stood up to the Nazis. So there's also that similar approach in trying to frighten people. And as we heard from Carol, who watched the Frontline documentary last night, she truly was frightened by what she saw.
Yeah, there's a lot frightening about this group, all the way down to the way that it has treated Yazidi women. So taking these young girls and women and use them as sex slaves, that is even taking it far past anything we've seen out of Al-Qaeda. And obviously, besides that, the sheer humanitarian crisis on the ground is something that we can't lose track of. So there's already 4 million refugees. There's 7.6 internally displaced persons, or IDPs. The economic damage has been over $200 billion so far for Syria, and not to mention 250,000 people dead.
Closer to home, Mayor Peduto says the terrorist attacks in France have done nothing to change his plan to host Syrian refugees in Pittsburgh. Governor Wolf says he will continue to work on resettling refugees, Syrian refugees in Pennsylvania. Some people oppose this. They say they have concerns about how these refugees are vetted. Can the refugees be vetted properly, in your opinion?
Yeah, so I'd have to get a really thorough look and understanding of what that vetting process entails, and I haven't had a chance to do that yet. A lot of the commentary that's been coming out surrounding refugees in the past couple of days, frankly, has been rhetoric, used to score political points. So I think what we need to do is take a step back, conduct some objective analysis on the situation. And, you know, it's up to our leaders, our political leaders, to explain to us what the vetting process entails and make sure that everybody's on the same page there. We'll never be on the same page when it comes to that, right, especially in such a partisan climate like we live in today. But I think we deserve more information.
And finally, we'll end on the question that I hate to ask, but that I have to ask, and that is, do you share the opinion that it's not a matter of if ISIS will strike within U.S. borders, but when?
Probably, but does that mean it's a small one-off attack, or does that mean it's something more along the lines of what we saw in Paris? I think we are saved by two things. One, geography. We have two oceans surrounding us, and two, demographics. We tend to have our immigrants assimilated better, where you have in Paris, you have kind of second, third generation Muslims from North Africa that are living in these banlieues and very detached from French culture. So I don't think we have that issue. Look, Paul, in the United States, we deal with mass shootings about once a week, right? And so I think it's something, unfortunately, that we've become used to. We've learned to live with it. There's mass hysteria when Al-Qaeda or ISIS are attached to a mass shooting, right? But unfortunately, in this country, we've grown callous to the fact that we do live with mass violence on a fairly regular basis. So to say that an ISIS attack is likely in this country in the future, unfortunately, it probably is. Hopefully, we can mitigate that, and hopefully our law enforcement and security services can be successful countering that, because I think they've done a really good job so far.
My guest has been Colin Clark. He's associate political scientist with the RAND Corporation, and he is delivering the John T. Ryan Memorial Lecture at the Global Engagement and Leadership Luncheon tomorrow at the Duquesne Club. That's at noon, and he is an instructor at both the University of Pittsburgh and Carnegie Mellon University. Check out his book, Terrorism, Inc., The Financing of Terrorism, Insurgency, and Irregular Warfare. Colin Clark, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me, Paul. Really appreciate it.
Coming up, how having a parent in prison impacts the lives of children. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.